Howard is a historian. He's a lifelong activist. He's written many books and plays. His classic, People's History of the United States, has had over 25 printings and is still going strong. His most recent book is Terrorism and War, which is used in some classes at Capitol this spring. Zinn has a marvelous ability to write clearly with humor, intelligence, passion, and honesty. I recommend reading anything by Howard Zinn. Zinn's own life has been at the center of the most important historical moments and movements of the past 40 years, from the Civil Rights Movement when he taught students like Alice Walker at Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia, and helped them organize protests against segregation. His anti-war activism during the Vietnam War included a trip to Hanoi, where three American prisoners of war were released to him. He was arrested himself numerous times then, and he helped shelter Father Philip Berrigan when the FBI pursued him for anti-war activism. Zinn has been active in the anti-nuclear weapons movement, in struggles for labor rights. He testified often in defense of people arrested during the 1980s and 1990s, protesting U.S. foreign policies that led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in El Salvador and Guatemala. Howard Zinn has a perspective. He has a perspective on U.S. foreign policy and the responsibilities of citizens in times of war and terror. Howard Zinn is a clear voice of conscience and hope. It's a privilege to have him here today. Please join me in welcoming Howard Zinn.
Well, thank you for inviting me to Capitol, and I'll try to talk about the subject I promised to talk about. So, what I usually like to do, I like to sort of make a connection between history and what is going on today. You know, I became a historian, not because I wanted to become a scholar in history and write for my colleagues and go to annual meetings of the American Historical Association, exciting as those are. I became a historian because I wanted to learn something about the past in order to be able to deal with the things that were going on in the world around me. And so I decided I wasn't going to become one of those historians who goes into the past and you never see him again. I suppose this attitude to history, this desire to deal with history in a very sort of immediate and important way, you know, came out of my own life experience, out of the fact, I suppose, that I didn't simply go from high school to college to graduate school to teaching. I didn't get lost in the academic world. I had about 10 years between high school and college. That should encourage those of you who are taking a little time to graduate. I wasn't a freshman in college until I was 27 years old. And in between, I did a number of things. And at the age of 18, I went to work in a shipyard, and I worked in a shipyard for 3 years. I didn't do it as a sociological experiment, interview the shipyard workers and find out what it's like. I just came from that kind of a background. I came from a working class background where kids did not go to college at the age of 18, they went to work. And so I worked in a shipyard for 3 years, and I suppose that in my upbringing and kind of neighborhood, kind of family that I grew up in, I developed a kind of class consciousness. And that's a phrase that's not often used in the United States. In fact, it's something that people don't like to talk about. People don't like to talk about there being different classes in the United States. People like to pretend, and the culture encourages us in this pretension, you know, that we're all big, one happy family. And we all have the same interest, you know. Exxon and I have the same interest, you know. Bush and I have the same interest. I learned early on that the society was divided between There's some very rich people, and there's some poor people, and a lot of people in between who are very nervous. I saw the culture trying to embrace us all into one unity, which was a false one, a kind of grand falloon. If any of you read Kurt Vonnegut, a grand falloon was his word to describe a kind of artificial assemblage of people. Any nation is a grand falloon. America is a grand falloon. I heard the phrases national security and national interest and national defense and decided early that those were very deceptive phrases, that there was not one national security. Although you hear very important people getting up there on television saying, well, we'll go here and go there, invade here or invade there if it's a question of national security. And my question is, whose security? Or maybe whose securities? But not national security was to me a way of corralling people into an activity that would not serve everybody in the same way. National defense, the national interest. I learned to reject all of those and to instead take a look at our society as a very diverse group of people with diverse interests, and our job being to find out what our interest is as opposed to the interests of the president or the interests of the generals or the interest of the industrialist, and see what I could do to further the interest of the great majority of the American people. And when I began to write history and began to teach history, that kind of class consciousness really affected what I was writing, what I was teaching. If you go into the history of the United States with that point of view, that is, if you go into the history of the United States with that kind of class consciousness, it soon becomes evident to you that what we learn in school about American history really omits so much that is vitally important to us. You know, you learn when the American Revolution, all the colonists united in a patriotic effort against England, and everybody was dazzled by the Boston Tea Party and the Boston Massacre and the Stamp Act Congress and all of that. But it wasn't quite that way. You know, John Adams himself said one third of the nation was in favor of the revolution, one third was against, and one third wasn't sure. And in fact, you know, we've had class conflict in the United States from the very beginning. We weren't all sort of pilgrims who came here wearing those same funny clothes and with the same interests. You know, some people came to this country in the 17th century with enormous grants of land from the king. Other people came here as servants. And of course, many others came here as black slaves. And all through the period before the revolution, there were uprisings, there were riots, there were conflict between tenant and landlord, slave rebellions. That part of our history is sort of shrouded in darkness. And instead, you know, we become sort of one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for some, pretending to be for all. But that class conflict, which was stilled for a while, somewhat during the American Revolution, because there's a way in which wars play the role of obscuring the internal conflicts in a group of people. You know, the war unites them, and so they're supposed to forget about their class interest. But in fact, during the Revolutionary War, that didn't work perfectly. There were mutinies during the revolution. I doubt that you learn about this when you learn about the revolution in school or in college or even in graduate school. I've very often found that what you learn in graduate school is not a lot different from what you learn in junior high school, you know, except maybe with footnotes. You didn't learn about the mutinies in the Revolutionary Army, mutinies of thousands of soldiers who were angry at the class privileges of the officers who got to eat well and got paid well and clothed well, and well, the privates and corporals in the Revolutionary Army were not given any pay, not given any shoes, and given poor slop to eat. And so they rebelled, thousands of them. The rebellion was finally put down. Washington had several of the mutineers executed. shot by their own fellow mutineers under orders of the officers. But the point is that this class consciousness continued all through. When the Constitutional Convention was assembled in 1787, there was a memory, a very strong memory of something that had happened the year before in Western Massachusetts, and rebellion of farmers. Harvey Wasserman just reminded me, he's writing something about Daniel Shays. Daniel Shays' Rebellion, some of you may remember that as an item on a multiple choice test. Shays' Rebellion. But there was a very significant uprising of farmers in Western Massachusetts and also in other parts of the states. These were farmers who were beset by heavy taxes levied on them by the rich who dominated the legislature of Massachusetts, and their farms were being taken away from them, their livestock taken away from them, and so they gathered by the thousands around the courthouses in Western Massachusetts in, Springfield and Great Barrington, Amherst and so on, and they would not let the courts go on. I mean, this was civil disobedience, this was rebellion, finally put down. And this is an important thing to note, the Constitution was adopted the year after that, and in normal American history classes, orthodox American history classes, you really don't learn about the connection between Shays' Rebellion and the Constitution. But the fact is that the Founding Fathers, when they gathered in Philadelphia, were very conscious of the fact that they faced rebellion in various parts of the country. And they wanted a fashion of government that was strong enough, a central government strong enough to put down rebellion. Because right after Shays' Rebellion, one of Washington's generals, General Henry Knox, wrote to him and said, I actually didn't bring his letter with me, but you'll have to take my word for it. Except that he said it more elegantly than I'm about to say it. Because, people in those days spoke more elegantly. The political leaders, however conservative they were, spoke with a kind of elegance of language which you can't find in political circles today. Knox writes through Washington and he says something like this. He says, "Look, George," well, not exactly that, but he must have had a flowery salutation, but he said, these people out there in Western Massachusetts, these rebels, many of them were veterans of the Revolutionary War. He said, they think that because they fought against Britain, that they deserve an equal share of the wealth of this country. What he was saying is, we need to fashion a government strong enough to put down rebellion. In fact, that's what the Constitutional Convention did. Constitutional Convention set up a government which would be able to take care of rebellions, a government that could have an army that could go out and take care of rebels, an army that could go out and deal with the Indians as the colonists moved westward into Indian territory, a government that would satisfy the needs of bondholders and merchants and bankers. I know we don't like to hear such things about the Constitution. We don't like to think that the Constitution is a class document, that the Constitution was put together to really benefit the wealthy interests in the country. But in fact, I believe that's what the Constitution was. Sure, it set up a more democratic structure than you had in monarchies, but not really a democracy. And the enormous amount of ballyhoo about the Constitution, especially some of you may remember during the bicentennial, 1987, 200 years after the Constitution was adopted, it was all over the country, there were all of this self-congratulation about the Constitution. I remember that Ronald Reagan even wrote an essay. That's hard to believe, but he wrote an essay. I think it was printed in some scholarly magazine. I think it was Parade magazine. And wrote an essay about how the Constitution was put together with such a perfect document. It could only have been put together with the guiding hand of God. Well, that's awe-inspiring. I mean, to think that she took time out from all of her duties to work on this particular spot of earth, on this particular document. Well, one person in high places at that time during the bicentennial dissented from the general, aura of congratulation. That was the one African-American member of the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall, and he said, what are you all getting excited about the Constitution? The Constitution legitimized slavery. Let's not forget that. Anyway, my point in all of this, and you may be wondering, when am I going to get to terrorism and war, which is supposed to be the title of... Occasionally, I get to the title of my talk, you see. But, you know, I have to lay the groundwork, which takes several hours. But the point I want to make, I suppose, is that the government of the United States, from the very beginning, has been a government mostly devoted to the interests of the upper classes. You look at the legislation, the history of legislation passed by Congress all through the centuries, from Alexander Hamilton's economic program presented to the first Congress, right up to the oil depletion allowances of our time, going through all the huge subsidies to railroads in the 19th century, into the merchant marine, into the bailout of the aircraft industries. The government mostly has legislated on behalf of the corporations and the rich. Occasionally, at certain points, there'd been legislation on behalf of the poor. In the 1930s and 1960s, when you had great movements throughout the country of strikes and general strikes and agitation, and then finally in the 30s, we got Social Security and we got unemployment insurance, we got subsidized housing, and then in the 60s, we got Medicare and Medicaid. But after that, what has happened again? I mean, all you have to look at the tax program presented by Bush, and you see, if you don't look at taxes from a class point of view, you don't understand what is going on. If you just read the headlines, and the media, you know, deceive us constantly about that, because all they tell us about is there will be a tax cut, or taxes will go up, taxes will go down. They don't ask the really important question, whose taxes? Who will it go up for? Who will it go down for? There's a class character to taxation, and if you look at the Bush tax proposal, you can see how that operates. Oh, tax cut, wonderful. And most of it going to the richest 1% of the population. So, yes, I'm trying to make a point about the class character of American politics, the American political structure, because at war, it's also true of war. War is a class phenomenon. Eugene Debs, if you don't mind my mentioning his name, a socialist, went to prison for 10 years, was sentenced to 10 years in prison during World War I. One of the things he was sentenced for was a speech he made in Canton, Ohio. It was a speech against the war. And you know, at that time, almost 1,000 people were imprisoned simply for speaking against American entrance into World War I. And Debs said in this speech in Canton, Ohio, no, we're not far, he said, the master class has always made the wars. The working class has always fought the wars. And that sums up the class character of wars. And it suggests something about wars, which are always presented as something that will do something for all of us, or something that will do something for people in other countries. And very important to really look at what class interests are benefited by the wars that are waged, supposedly on behalf of liberty and democracy and the freedoms of other people and so on. There were two experiences in my life which affected my thinking about war. I was in the Air Force. When I left the shipyard, I enlisted in the Air Force. I'd been reading about fascism and reading about Mussolini and Hitler, and this was, as you know, it was the good war. Although if you look at Studs Terkel's oral history, which he interviews people of that era, the wonderful oral history entitled The Good War, and you may notice that he put quotation marks around good war. And the reason he put quotation marks around it is because this good war, this best of wars, was something that on second thought and on third thought was not purely good. A lot more complicated than simply a good war. I once had a student who wrote about wars, and she wrote a paper about wars, and she said, you know, wars are like wines. There are good years and bad years. She said, but war is not like wine. War is like cyanide. One drop and you're dead. So I was an enthusiastic bombardier in the good war, and I dropped bombs in various places in Europe and did what I was told, did what I'd been trained for. And I succumbed to this jump in logic which happens in wartime, and the jump goes something like this. The other side is evil, therefore we must be good. Doesn't follow. The other side may be evil, but that doesn't mean that we are good. And if you looked at the terrible evil of fascism in World War II, and then looked at the countries fighting fascism, these countries were not models of democracy and liberty. These were the great empires of the Western world, yes, fighting against fascism. But it's important to know that. Important to distinguish between the motives of the young men like myself who volunteered in the war in order to defeat fascism and the motives of the leaders of countries whose first motive, I don't believe, was the defeat of fascism, but had something to do with national power and national privilege and the rivalry against other empires trying to muscle their way into the existing empires of the world. I didn't think about any of this until I came out of the military, until really after the end of the war. Didn't think about the missions I had flown. And I guess I didn't think about it until I read John Hersey's book, Hiroshima. A small book. John Hersey was a journalist who went to Hiroshima right after the bombing and talked to the survivors. You can imagine what the survivors looked like. People who were blind, people without limbs, people whose skin was horrible to look at. And he interviewed these people, and he wrote about what he saw and what he heard from them. And for the first time, the human consequences of bombing came back to me. Well, it came to me for the first time, really. When you bomb, as I did, as people in the Air Force did, from 30,000 feet, you didn't see anybody down there. You didn't hear any screams. You didn't see blood, you didn't see children with mangled limbs, you didn't, none of that. And so, oh, you could come back from a mission and be proud that, you know, you hit the target and not know what happened to human beings down there. And so I began to think about bombing and began to think about the bombing that took place in the good war, where at the beginning of that war, the people in the Western world, people in the so-called civilized world, had looked at Mussolini bombing Ethiopia in 1935, bombing the capital of Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, just dropping bombs on the city. Horrified, we were horrified. This was something new in warfare. You're not supposed to do that. Warfare is soldier against soldier. This was dropping bombs on defenseless people in a city. And then the Germans and the Italians did that in the Spanish Civil War, bombing Madrid and Guernica, and the Germans at the beginning of World War II bombing Rotterdam and Coventry, and hundreds, a few thousand people died in each of those raids. And this was barbaric, everybody said. And soon we, the good guys, were doing the same thing, only on a much larger scale. We were bombing cities. With a deliberate policy by the British High Command, joined in by the Americans, deliberate policy to bomb the working class populations of German cities in order to destroy their morale. Set something that was repeated later in the Vietnam War, where we bombed and bombed and bombed, not necessarily military targets, but to destroy the will of the population. Tens of thousands die in Frankfurt and Hamburg and then in Dresden, we don't know how many, 80,000, 100,000 in one night of bombing. You read Kurt Vonnegut's book, Slaughterhouse 5. He was there. He was a prisoner of war at the time that the, and prisoner of war in Dresden at the time Dresden was bombed. And it's a book really worth reading. And then in the spring of 1945, even before Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in the spring of 1945, the United States Air Force drops firebombs on Tokyo, sets Tokyo ablaze. 100,000 people die in one night of bombing Tokyo. Now, how many Americans know about that? Well, Americans know about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But My point is, war corrupts everybody who engages in it. They're the bad guys, you're the good guys, and very soon in war, it's hard to distinguish between the bad guys and the good guys. And the war may seem to solve the problem. Oh, we got rid of Hitler. Oh, we got rid of Mussolini. Oh, we got rid of the Japanese military machine. Oh, we got rid of Saddam Hussein. Oh, be happy. War seems to solve the problem, and it gives you a quick fix. And then you look around and you find that the fundamental problems of the world have not been solved by war. Looking around after World War II, the good war, where fascism was gone, which was great. Well, it was gone from Germany and Italy and Japan, but was it gone from the world? No. Was militarism gone from the world? Was racism gone from the world? Was colonialism gone from the world? No, not at all. I remember getting, when I was discharged from the Air Force, getting a letter from the general of the armies, Marshall, and not exactly a personal letter to me, a letter sent to 16 million who had served in the military, but the letter said something like, I'm getting very good at paraphrasing generals' letters, the letter said, congratulations, you know, we've won the war, great war for freedom and liberty. The world will be a different place now. Didn't turn out that way. The world was not really a very different place. As we've seen, what have we had since World War II? War after war after war after war. And 50 million people were dead in the course of the good war. And, the World War II remains a very complicated moral issue. But it raises the question of whether war is really the solution to the problems we face in the world. However inviting it seems at the moment. You know, violence is a quick fix. With violence, you can do something fast. If you want to accomplish something without violence, well, you have to think. You have to be more intelligent. You have to take more time. You have to be more ingenious. You have to figure out different ways that maybe haven't even been used yet. You have to be patient and you have to be persistent. Here we are, the human race, so endowed, so smart, right? All you have to do is, go on a jet plane and you realize, wow, the human beings are really smart. Computers and trips to the moon and all of that. But with regard to solving the problems of the world, we're so dumb. And why can't we use that human ingenuity to work on devising ways of solving the problems of the world without killing huge numbers of people? That I see is the really great task of the human race in this century, which is supposed to have started out, freshly with something new, but started out with a repetition of the old. War is terrorism. It's very important to remember that. After 9/11, the impression was given throughout the country that, this is an act of terrorism, and enclosed that act of terrorism as if nothing else was terrorism. What happened to us, 9/11, was terrorism, and of course it was. But it ignored the fact that we have been experiencing terrorism. People all over the world have been experiencing terrorism. And although, sure, 9/11 was close to home and it was here in the States, people all over the world have been experiencing terrorism in far, far greater numbers even than the 3,000 people who died in the Twin Towers. But we haven't wanted to recognize that. We've been so self-absorbed. Right after 9/11, the New York Times had reporters interview people in various third world countries, asking them for their reactions to what happened on September 11th. And the reactions were all the same. That is, they all said, really, this was terrible. We sympathize with you. We sympathize with this terrible act of 3,000 people being killed in one, vicious act. But you also have to understand that we, in our various countries, we have lost hundreds of thousands of people in all sorts of situations, many of which have been condoned by the United States and we've lost people in Guatemala, 100,000, 200,000 people in Guatemala as a result of a government installed by the United States of America. So you can't just build a wall around, you know, New York, 9/11, and just not concentrate on anything else. They spoke to one person in Africa who said, this is bad. 3,000 people die in one night. In Africa, millions of people are dying because of AIDS. And your government is giving a pittance in dealing with that. You know, you're spending billions and billions to deal with what you call the war on terrorism, but you're ignoring the conditions in the rest of the world. So I think it's important to enlarge the picture when we think about terrorism. Think about war as terrorism. Think about starvation as terrorism, as sickness as terrorism. Think of people dying in huge numbers because they don't have clean water. People dying of diseases that could be cured with a fraction of our military budget if we really decided that that was the wise and moral thing to do. The war on terrorism has always been, in my mind, a fake. You cannot make war on terrorism. It's not that sort of a thing. Terrorism is not a place that you can bomb and destroy and say, we've taken care of terrorism. Terrorism is something, and the government itself at various times has conceded this, but you have to look sharply and put all their contradictory statements together in order to try to figure out what is going on. In Bush's State of the Union address, he started off saying, we are winning the war on terrorism. And then a few paragraphs later, he says, there are tens of thousands of trained terrorists all over the world. I don't see how those two things go together. You bomb Afghanistan for a year, presumably because you're waging war on terrorism. At the end of that year, there are tens of thousands of trained terrorists all over the world, and as the government itself says, there are terrorists in a dozen or 20 or 30 countries in the world. So why do you bomb Afghanistan? Why do you kill several thousand people in Afghanistan? You know, something that the American public still doesn't recognize, that our bombing in Afghanistan killed, we don't know exactly how many, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 civilians, and how many wounded, and how many, I remember seeing and it was rare because the newspapers only give you occasional glimpses only of what the human result was of our bombing of Afghanistan. But I saw one picture one day in the New York Times of a 10-year-old boy, Afghan boy, in a hospital, and he was blind and had lost his arms as a result of an American bombing. And I wondered, well, how many other scenes like that took place? You know, you drop bombs and people get killed. And as a bombardier, I've always been interested in bombing, it's very interesting to follow. The bombs get smarter and smarter, the people making the decisions get dumber and dumber, and you get all sorts of deceptions and lies. And even with the smartest of bombs, you say, our missile went astray. Oh, we bombed this marketplace. We bombed this truck carrying these old people to a meeting. No, and the war on terrorism is a fake. It was designed to turn our attention away from real problems that we have in this country and in the world, and to persuade us that our government is doing something about terrorism, something to protect us. In fact, I believe the government has not been doing anything to protect us. I think the government has been endangering us by its policies in the world. And because I believe that when you set out to bomb this country and that country, you create enormous amounts of indignation and anger among people in the world, the kind of indignation and anger that leads some small portion of those angry people to become fanatic and to engage in terrorism. As a bombardier, I'm always interested in the designation of military targets. And that's supposed to take care of everything. If they say, we only bomb military targets. Those of you who were around during the Vietnam War or have read about the Vietnam War know how often the government said about Vietnam, in the bombing of Vietnam, and of course, which we dropped more bombs on Vietnam than we had dropped on Europe and Japan in World War II, on this tiny country, napalm, cluster bombs, and always said we're bombing military targets, the result being 2 million people dead in Vietnam. I've always been interested in this excuse, or we're only bombing military targets, because I knew it was a lie, an absolute lie. Well, a lie in the sense that, depends on what you call a military target. Do you know that after the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima, in one of his talks, President Truman said, "We have just dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, a military target." In the middle of the first Gulf War, in February 1991, the United States dropped a bomb on an air raid shelter in Baghdad. There were perhaps 400 people in the air raid shelter, mostly women and children, immediately dead, incinerated by a direct hit from the bomb on the air raid shelter. And the thought was after that, well, the United States government would probably say, well, it was a mistake, the bomb went off course, so we got wrong intelligence information. No, they didn't say that. They said, we deliberately bombed this air raid shelter because it was a military target. And what made the air raid shelter a military target? They said there was electronic equipment in the air raid shelter. Well, it raises an interesting moral issue. What if there is electronic equipment in an air raid shelter where there are 400 people, including women and children? Do you then bomb it in order to get rid of the whatever electric equipment there is at the expense of these 400 lives? Do you do that? Because if Iraq had this electrical equipment, they would certainly win the war. There's something, you know, absurd about that whole prospect. In fact, it turned out there was no electronic equipment in the air raid shelter. Reporters going through the ruins immediately after said they found no trace of anything that could be called military equipment. I say this just to alert you, if you aren't already alerted, to the amount of lies and deceptions that accompany wars. The American people do not get a full picture of what we do in other countries. You have to read the foreign press, really, to get information that you will not get in the American press. If you want to get a picture, for instance, of the casualties that we have just caused in this war on Iraq, and yes, Saddam Hussein is out, and that's great, but you notice the population is not overflowing with joy as a result of this. They're glad to get rid of Saddam Hussein, but they don't want the Americans there, and so many of them are grieving for the dead and wounded caused by the American bombing. And you would have to read the newspapers very carefully to pick out all the instances in which the bombing has produced, you know, terrible things. And because these things appear just occasionally now and then, little glimpse here, you don't really get the full horror of the bombing. You'd have to, I don't know what I have here, but family dreads telling father that three daughters are dead. Missile hits a market in Baghdad, 58 are said killed. There's a picture, a rare picture actually, of a wounded Iraqi, a young Iraqi's wounds of war. It's a picture of an Iraqi boy, he looks as if he's about 13 or 14, who lost both of his legs in a bomb strike, and he lies in a hospital in Saddam City. And you have dispatch, you know, from Canadian source, which tells about how the Red Cross is staggered by the number of dead and wounded as a result of the bombing. Where you read, and this actually appeared, I think, in the Chicago Tribune, we read about a doctor in Iraq who comes back from a night shift at the hospital and finds that 9 members of his family are dead as a result of the bombing, his wife and 5 children and other members of the family. Yes, I think, you know, unless you confront the full horror of war, it becomes very easy to accept a kind of moral equation. Well, war is bad, but we got rid of Saddam Hussein. I suggest that we think about that more carefully. I've got to stop soon in order to leave time, because we're supposed to get out of this place by 4:15, so I'll just take like a couple of minutes and then turn it over to you. Let's see if I have anything else to say. I have a few hours left, but no, I won't talk about patriotism. you can bring that up. I'll tell you what to bring up. This is very democratic. I will tell you what questions to ask. You can ask me about patriotism. Ask me about supporting the GIs. I like that subject. The only thing I'll say is, I believe there are, and I say this on the basis of going around the country and speaking to all sorts of audiences, and not audiences that necessarily are in support of my anti-war position. I speak to high school assemblies, you know, high school kids are sort of forced at gunpoint to come into the assembly hall to listen to me, and these are high school kids are very militarized. You know, junior ROTC and macho war stories and all that. But I've had wonderful reactions from high school students all over talking about the war. I find that there's so many people whose initial support for the war begins to fade as soon as they get a little bit of information, as soon as a few questions are asked that haven't been asked before. So I'm really very confident that really large numbers of people in this country are kind of instinctively opposed to war and the horror of war, despite the lies of the government, despite the overwhelming propaganda that we're subjected to, where you turn on TV and all you see is Rumsfeld, Ari Fleischer, oh, we'll have a change of pace, back to Rumsfeld. Maybe that's why people all over the world oppose the war in Vietnam. All over the world, in Iraq, people all over the world oppose the war in Iraq. Overwhelmingly. Why? Why is such a discrepancy between the feeling of people all over the world here? Maybe it's because people in the rest of the world do not have to watch CNN. Maybe they have information that we don't have. Maybe they see things in a different perspective than we do. Well, I wake up in the morning and I very often feel that I'm living in an occupied country. Somehow that some alien force has taken possession of this country. Really, that's how I feel. I mean, they're spending billions on war, they're starving education, they're starving healthcare, they're even taking away money from veterans' benefits, the irony, waging a war taking away money from veterans' benefits. An occupied country, I feel it, sort of the country's been taken over by people who don't care. A small group of men really don't care. They don't care about liberty, they don't care about democracy, they don't care about human life. And I think it's the job of the American people, to restore democracy, that is to take the country back. Thank you. Will I hear you? Is there a mic that you can use, or will I hear your questions?
We don't have a mic, but if people will stand up, I think, and speak loudly, and please try to be brief since we don't have a lot of time.
Okay. Stand up, speak loudly, okay.
How do we change the country back in the face of...
Excuse me, sir, start all over.
In the face of what I think to be essentially a fascist takeover of the instruments of government proceeding in the case, how do we change democracy?
Oh, you've given me a very easy job. It's very simple, yeah. How have people in the past brought about change? How did people in the South do away with racial segregation when it looked impossible, because when all the odds were against them, when every instrument of government in the South was held by white supremacists, when the federal government itself was collaborating, really, with the racist South and maintaining things as they are? How did they do it? No, there's no magical formula. We've had this experience with the civil rights movement, with the labor movement, with the anti-war movement. You build a citizens' movement. You build it gradually. You build it. It takes time. It takes persistence. You build groups of people all over the country who are brought together in a common cause, and you build it to the point where, well, at a certain time in history, if you're lucky and if enough things have happened all over the country, and if enough people have done enough small things to build up into something large, then something may happen. Then you may end racial segregation in the South, and you may bring a war to an end, and you may change the consciousness of the country about sexual equality and about the rights of gays and lesbians or about the rights of disabled people. Yeah, we're going to need a new social movement in this country, a combination of the energy and persistence of the labor movement and the black movement and the Latino movement and, you know, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, a combination of all of that energy and a new kind of movement, the environmental movement. At this moment, that looks like a distant possibility, but, you know, things always look like a distant possibility when you're at the beginning of a movement for social change. But if you don't persist, and if you don't act as if someday something will happen, then nothing will happen. Yes.
I'll read this real quick. The multinational capitalist system seems to have moved away from supporting very overt, obvious forms of Western colonization in favor of cultivating neo-colonial puppet leaders in weaker nations, except in the case of Israel. Is the tail wagging the dog in the case of American pro-Zionist interests, trumping even multinational business interests, which suffer because of Arab mistrust and righteous anger?
He was talking about the change in from sort of overt colonialism to sort of the multinational control influence of, in other countries by economic means and so on. But you're suggesting that Israel is an example, that in Israel, as you put it, the tail is wagging the dog, that Israel and pro-Zionist influences are affecting American policy, influencing American policy unduly, and you're suggesting that corporate interests in the United States are suffering as a result of that because of... because of the what is happening in the Arab world? I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure that is so. You know, corporate interests seem to make out no matter what. You know, I mean, there are distinctions, you know, among corporate interests. And, you know, there are situations in which some kinds of industries don't do as well and others, you know, are doing well. But I don't think there's that kind of conflict between American policy towards the Middle East and corporate policy. And corporate policy. What has American policy been? It's been generally to use Arabs against Jews and Jews against Arabs. And the policy, of course, of a very crass support of Sharon is, I think, sort of a consequence of Bush finding that he and Sharon think the same way. You know, they believe in force to solve problems. It's going to take something, you know, very drastic to change, you know, that situation. Yes.
Can you comment on the role of the independent media and suggest where people might be able to get information other than the foreign press? What independent media here in the country do you recognize?
This is a question from a member of the independent media. Who asked, where can we turn for independent information? It's an important question because, you know, when we have a very misinformed public, we desperately need alternative sources of information. And I tell people, you know, read alternative publications, you know, read The Nation, read In These Times, read The Progressive, read Z Magazine, you know, read all these strange things that that are, you know, just on the border of respectability, you see. But that's where you'll get information that you won't get anywhere else. And listen to Pacifica Radio, listen to alternative radio stations, listen to Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman's program, listen to David Barsamian's alternative radio, which he picks up talks and interviews people and then I think sends it out via satellite, who knows how he does it, to radio stations all over the country which may pick him up. But yeah, there are these alternative sources. And then, of course, there's the internet. The internet, I think, has become a very, very important counter to the domination of the media by the great conglomerates. I think without the internet, we would not have had these demonstrations against the war worldwide. It would have been impossible to have that one day worldwide demonstration of 10 million or more people against the war. It wouldn't have been possible if we didn't have the internet. So, you know, we're in a position of having to seek out independent sources of information. And one thing I tell people very often is, stop watching TV and go to the library. Go to the library. Yeah, just go to the library. I was very happy to read that there are librarians somewhere in the country who are shredding their documents, their records, because the FBI, you know, has been asking librarians to submit records of who borrowed what, you know? So this library is shredding its records. Usually the shredding is done by the other side in order to conceal the terrible things that they're doing. So this is a kind of rebellion against that. I haven't been paying attention back there. At the very, very back, yes.
Could you comment a little bit about, you know, it's like we hear rhetoric from our government. I think we also hear rhetoric from the other side, too. And the thing that always overcomes all the rhetoric is to actually hear the stories of people who suffer. And one comment that I heard was someone who had been in Jordan for a long time. She said the Jordanian hospitals are flooded.
Well, I think, you know, you said it, you know, that, we do not get, you know, and we do not know in real, in our face detail what is happening to human beings behind these sort of abstractions that we see in the papers, you know, Palestinian-Israeli clashes and suicide bombers, and will there be another conference and so on. And we certainly have not learned in this country very much about the suffering of the Palestinians under Israeli occupation. And Americans who've been there and who've sent back or written back to this country tell the stories of what happened when these refugee camps were attacked by Sharon's army and the tanks, or what happened when the homes of Palestinians were destroyed. And you all, you know, read about the young American woman who tried to stop a bulldozer from destroying a home and was run over twice and killed. And yes, we need to look behind the headlines and think of what is happening to human beings. Yes.
You said we might want to ask you about patriotism.
Yes.
It seems that one way that is being promoted is because they don't tell us the truth about things such as how many people have died in Iraq on the other side. We know how many British and American soldiers. What? How can we get them to tell us what really happened?
Yeah, it's one of the troubling things about so-called patriotism is the emphasis on what happens to your people, Americans, as opposed to the other people. If an American dies, it's much, much more important than if 100 other people die. And, you know, at the end of the Gulf War, reporters were questioning Colin Powell, and he was saying rather proudly that in the Gulf War of 1991, the United States had lost, you know, maybe 100 or 200 people. And then a reporter asked, well, how many Iraqi casualties were there? And Powell's reply was, that's something that I have not been terribly interested in. Really, that's what he said. And that's generally true, you know, not only of Colin Powell, it's true of the press, true of television, true of our political leaders. And this terrible nationalism in which, I mean, in which somehow our children are more important than other children. I think if we could begin to really create a different kind of psychology, which is a true global psychology, in which everybody is equal, in which all children are equal, well, then there could be no war. Because war is always a war against children. And then you would think that if you're killing children in Iraq or Russia or China or elsewhere, you're killing your own children. I have sometimes said to people who there were always conflict and controversy about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And people would say, most Americans to this day believe we had to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki in order to win the war. And I try to give them the evidence that shows that's absolutely not true. You know, we did not have to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki in order to win the war. We did not have to kill all those people. But then I would say, well, even if you grant that, what if in August of 1945, somebody said to you, we can end this war in Asia more quickly if we only killed 100,000 American children? Would you agree to that? Well, the answer is obvious. Then why would we be willing to kill 100,000 children in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? That means that we don't consider the lives of children there as important as the lives of our children. And I think that we have to begin changing the thinking of ourselves and other people so that, expand the Declaration of Independence. All people are created equal, not just here in the United States, but everywhere in the world.
Thanks very much. Okay.